This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. I'm sure you've heard this advice before. If you want to get a good job, go to college. Then there's this piece of data. The average college graduate makes much more money than the average high school graduate. Our guest, Wharton professor Peter Capelli, says it's not that simple. A sizable number of students who get into college don't graduate. The uncertain job market coupled with student debt means that financial security is not a given once you get that diploma. Most of the recent grads have landed jobs that have little or nothing to do with their major. Capelli is the author of Will College Pay Off? A Guide to the Most Important Financial Decisions, a decision you'll ever make. He's the George W. Taylor Professor of Management at the Wharton School, also director of Wharton's Center for Human Resources, and he's been a guest on Radio Times in the past. And Peter Capelli, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Are you telling us not to go to college?
I guess this is kind of caveat emptor, right? So I think there's a couple of things if you're a parent or a student to think about. The first is that not all college experiences are the same, right? And they've become much more different than variated than when we were in college. You know, we used to think college meant 4 years on a leafy campus. And for a lot of people now, it means occasional trips to an office park to take courses at some, you know, extension part of a college or a university. And, you know, as we've added more kids to the system and more people have graduated, it's up 30% the number of graduates from four-year colleges in the last 10 years.
Wow.
It's a pretty amazing
Wow.
increase. You know, it gets the value of a college degree starts to erode. It doesn't differentiate you that much. And so I think, you know, particularly if you're paying for this, you're not an extremely wealthy family, and this isn't just consumption, and you really have to have a job afterwards to make it go, you got to think pretty carefully about whether you're going to get in trouble.
You write in this book that 70% of high school graduates get into college.
Yeah.
Did I read that right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's dramatically different from a generation or two ago.
Right. Now, most of those are four-year college, but not all of them. If you look at four-year colleges in the 1960s, I think the figure was about 10% or so of high school graduates going. And now it's about 38% go on to four-year colleges, which is a huge increase, right? And, you know, one of the issues that happens as we expand access is that a lot of kids go who wouldn't have gone before, and a lot of those kids probably don't have the maturity yet, right? And sometimes maybe not the ability to handle serious college work. So, you know, there's a ton of remedial education that goes on in college, which is pretty expensive because you're paying for things that you should have learned in high school. So some measure recently, I think it was about 25% of college students are taking remedial classes in college. So they're repeating stuff in college. And, you know, at public policy, this matters. Pretty expensive way to do it. And for a parent, it matters a lot, too.
Well, but I'm thinking of that message, and we hear it from the president. We hear
yes,
it from all
right.
sorts of people, which is that if you go to college and if you graduate, you will make more money than,
yeah.
than a high school graduate.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I found interesting in your book is going back to, I guess, in the heydays of unions, that going to college and going to high school, there wasn't that dramatic a difference between the kind of
right.
money that you would make.
Yeah.
But is there a big difference today, or is it how you sort of calculate those numbers?
Well, there's a big difference. It's 60% is the average. But here's what that number means, because you hear it a lot, right? They're looking at the workforce as a whole. The average worker in the U.S. workforce has been out of college for 20 years.
Right.
Right? So its average worker is about 46. And they're saying the average worker makes about 60% more with a college degree than that worker with a high school degree. But the assumption behind that is they're otherwise identical people, and that's absolutely not true, right? The people who go to college are systematically different than the people who don't go to college. They have families that have more money, more resources to help, more social connections. They would have done better than the average high school graduate even if they hadn't gone to college.
Mm.
Now, how much is that difference? Well, we don't really know for sure, but it's part of the calculation, right? And the fact that that's true on average for the average worker who's been out of college for 20 years doesn't say that it's going to be true for the person who's entering college right now. And in fact, that number is still a pretty good gap, but it's not as great as it is for the average worker. And it tells you nothing about where it's going to be when you're 20 years out or so, right? So, and I think, you know, for parents and for kids thinking about going to college, you probably shouldn't pay too much attention to these overall average numbers, because they're made up of, you know, Wharton students and then kids who, you know, went to really low-tier colleges someplace else, you know.
But are you telling us that college is really just for middle-class or upper-middle-class or even wealthy kids?
Well, I think for people who are wealthy, they can see college as consumption, right? So we're going to college, we're sending you to college because it will make you a better person, and there are all kinds of wonderful life outcomes that are seem to be associated with college. All that's true. Then there's the issue, which is all I'm focusing on here, is about the money side.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, will it pay off? If you have a lot of money, and this is consumption, it doesn't matter that much. But if you're borrowing money, let's say, to go to college, and student loans are up, I think it's over 150% since about 2000, right? And the average kid now, I think, is graduating with about $35,000 of loans. So you're paying for it by taking out loans in particular, you really do have to worry about whether you're going to get a job afterwards that pays off. So the fact that you make more money than a high school graduate from a financial point of view is not the question. The question is, can you actually make enough to pay off the costs of going? That's the question.
Well, and I think about that gifted high school student or graduate whose family would be the first person in their family to go to college, perhaps come from limited means. You know, we want this person to succeed in college. We want them to get that good job, and we want them to have that kind of future.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like you're saying perhaps the odds are kind of against these people.
Well, I'd say if you are a poor kid who is really gifted, things are going to be fine for you. Right?
Because you're really gifted.
Because you're really gifted. And there's financial aid at private schools is astonishingly great, actually. At elite schools like the University of Pennsylvania, if parents make less than $100,000 a year, it's pretty much a free ride for you. The financial aid is enormous. And here's an interesting statistic. If you look at the average kid in the U.S. who has financial aid, the difference between going to a state university, which we used to think of as the cheap way to go, and a private university is only $9,000.
Huh.
And the reason is state tuition has risen much faster than private tuition, about 50% faster in the last 20 or 30 years or so. So state universities are no longer necessarily the cheap deal that they used to be. And the private schools, at least the wealthy ones, have gotten much more generous with their financial aid. So it could be cheaper, actually, for you to go to a private school if you're poor than to try to go to a state university where they don't have as much financial aid, but the tuition's lower.
And is that because, like Pennsylvania, there were cutbacks in higher education, and so state universities had to increase their tuition.
Right. That's it. And I think, you know, the other problem in some states is that the appropriations were cut, and also the state legislature won't allow the colleges to raise their tuition. So then the colleges are in a bind, and the bind starts to bite the students because courses get cut back and services get cut back. And it could be that you can't complete your major or you can't complete your degree because the courses are so constrained that you can't fit them into your schedule to get out. And one of the biggest things I think we ought to pay attention to is, will you actually graduate from college, right? So all the discussion about, you know, college pays off assumes you've got the degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
And getting the degree is not so easy, right? So, you know, only 40% – this is a – I should ask parents to sit down when we say this one because this is really a scary statistic. Only 40% of full-time college students graduate in 4 years, which, you know, is kind of mind-blowing when you think about it. And none of us, I think, thought of that when we were going to college. And as a parent, when my kids went, I didn't ever think of the possibility that they wouldn't get out in 4 years. But actually, neither of my kids got out in 4 years. And, you know, often it's not their fault.
Well, it took me six, as I explained to you, as a college dropout for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the question is, why does even private universities like the University of Pennsylvania, why do they cost so much? I mean, isn't that part of if you're looking about whether it's going to pay off,
yep,
if you're saddled with $35,000 of debt, why do colleges cost so much?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, and it's partly a redistribution story, right? So if your family is very wealthy, you will pay this very high sticker price, and the college uses its other resources to help kids who are poor go. So, you know, you can think about this as cutting the price for poorer kids, but, you know, I don't think it's any kind of market effort here to try to maximize students or student revenue or something. They're just doing it for social purposes to allow poorer kids to go. So there's kind of a redistribution going on. Why is college so expensive? Why has tuition gotten so much higher? At the private universities, I think the reason is a lot of competition now to offer better services for students, right? And some of that are things you can see, like nicer dormitories, which everybody points to. But really the big increase has come in administrative support. So, you know,
more administration.
More administration, but a lot of it, and most of it, I think, aimed at students. So, for example, the average student in the U.S., as we said, graduates, 40% graduate in 4 years. At Penn, 98% of the kids graduate in 4 years. Right? Now, why is that? It's not because the kids who come in are perfect, although they certainly have a lot of ability. It's because Penn and colleges like it spend a lot of time and energy to make sure the kids are going to get out. There's a lot of tutoring. There's a lot of support. They make sure that the courses are there so you don't get stuck in these situations where you can't finish your major on time. So all these support services, all these tutoring, all this psychological counseling, all that stuff costs a lot of money. But, you know, it could pay off for you if you're thinking, you know, the odds of graduating on time go way up. It's much cheaper to pay a lot up front than it is to have your kid take 5 years to finish, which is what happens elsewhere.
We're almost up on a break here, but I'm thinking about colleges, universities in other countries where it's free. How would that change that were free?
Right. Well, you know, the experience of college in most other countries, and I did go to college in England. And it was – well, I went to Oxford, so it wasn't – you know, that was expensive, right? Mm-hmm. But if you think about most of these – of those colleges in the continent in particular, you're living at home and you're taking a bus to the university and you're in big lecture classes. And at the end of the year, you got one big set of exams. You don't expect to see your professor. You don't have much contact with anybody. You know, it's a very different experience, and it is a college degree, but – it's not, you know, it's not quite the same experience. Hmm. And interestingly, if you ask like employers what they want, at least in the U.S., they really seem to be much more interested in all those things that you get outside of the classroom from being in college. So you wouldn't get those. And so it wouldn't be the same thing if you had that kind of college experience.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Peter Capelli is our guest. He is the director of the Wharton Center for Human Resources, also author of this book we're talking about. It asks this question, will college pay off? A guide to the most important financial decision you'll ever make. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Just a recap here. Think about hospital financing or casino management or international tourism. These are trendy college degrees. They're being sold to students as a surefire way to land a good job after graduation. Our guest Peter Capelli says, be careful. Colleges aren't always good at predicting where future jobs will be. And we are talking about will college pay off? And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One of the things you say in this book is that colleges are, in a sense, kind of selling either courses or degrees that look like jobs, including hospital financing. I mean, that's a job.
Oh,
right?
I saw a bowling industry management degree.
You can
recently
get a degree in that.
Yeah, yeah. You name it. You can get a degree in it. I think what's happened, you know, particularly after the Great Recession and the experience of a lot of college kids graduating and not being able to find any job, and about 25% say they haven't found a job that uses any of their major or degree, you know, specialties, is that everybody's nervous, rightly, about whether this college will get me a job or not. And the colleges step in and said, well, we'll solve this for you, and we'll market these very practical degrees. And the problem is they're heavy on marketing. Mm-hmm. Right? So one estimate of the for-profit schools, which are clearly into this domain, is that they spend about a quarter of their revenues on marketing. And you can see it, you know, in Philadelphia or any city, on the subway ads and the buses. You see ads everywhere for some college that's got some degree program which is not philosophy, right? I mean, they're pitching something very practical in healthcare or accounting or something like that. The problem is that the marketing sounds great, but you got no idea whether it's true, whether anybody actually hires those people or not when you graduate. And the government doesn't require that the colleges report that. So the one thing they do have to report is graduation rates.
Right.
And so you can find that for any college.
Right.
But what percentage of the graduates actually get jobs and get jobs in their field, we don't know.
So there is this – I mean, are colleges and universities, are they misrepresenting themselves they say that?
Yeah, some certainly are. There's an interesting paper by a couple of law school deans, and the paper is called Law School Deans in Jail. And what they did is they looked at the claims that law schools were making about the placement rates of their graduates, and they said that these claims were knowingly false and misleading, and this is fraud. And so they said if, you know, these colleges, most of them, they thought, were committing fraud in what they were saying about their placement rates. And if law schools are committing fraud, my guess is lots of other places are as well.
So what do we do with that information? And are you saying we just cannot predict the future? I'm thinking about healthcare.
Yep.
You've got baby boomers retiring. Got to count for something related to healthcare.
Sure. And, you know, it's probably true that there will be more jobs in healthcare. The problem is everybody hears that, and so everybody goes into healthcare, and then you got the problem that the market is flooded, right? So we're on to maybe two problems, that maybe just separate them. One is, can you predict where the job market will be when you graduate? And the answer, frankly, is no, you can't. And the problem, if you think about it, is kids are picking their colleges when they're 17. So actually, they're picking really in their last year of their – in their junior year, right, is where they're going to apply. They make the decision in their senior year, and then they graduate. Most of them graduate in 5 years from a four-year program. So that's – you're 6 years out. And you're trying to predict where the job market will be 6 years out. Mm-hmm. And it's impossible to know. I mean, it's just impossible. It's not like if you read the right stuff, you'd figure it out. Part of the problem, too, is, as we said, even if you knew, everybody else knows, too. And then the market floods. Here's a quick example. The hottest job in the U.S. the last 4 years or so has been petroleum engineering. Petroleum engineers made about 30 to 50% more than the next highest paid college graduate in the U.S.
Wow. What were they making? What kind of
stuff? $90,000 a year.
Wow. Good money.
And so two things have happened. One is kids started pouring into petroleum engineering programs, and they're now starting to flood the market because now they're all graduating, right? And at the same time, now oil prices have collapsed. Oil exploration is collapsing or pulling back, and you got this huge cohort of petroleum engineers on the job market. Well, these guys, you know, 10 or 15 years ago were waiting tables because there were no petroleum engineering jobs. And then there's a boom, and then there's going to be a bust again. So I think I would stay away from these – I mean, to be blunt, I guess I would just stay away from these majors that are and degrees which are targeted on one occupation. Partly because you can't predict it. And secondly, if you're wrong, it's not clear what you're going to do as a backup.
Well, in fact, you say, and there's been so much focus on this STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yep.
You say there is, sort of picking up on what you just said there, there's no actual shortage. And even when you look at the M, the math, and the science, they don't necessarily – I mean, if you're thinking about pay and, I guess, security
– right.
They don't really deliver those goods.
Right. Well, there's a study in Texas that found that college graduates in sociology made more money than college graduates in biology, right? There's not a lot of jobs for math majors and science majors, and there's never been a lot of jobs there. The jobs and where the markets are hot are in almost entirely in engineering, and they're not the same jobs every year. That's the problem, right? So if you become a petroleum engineer – and there's no market for petroleum engineering. You can't switch and do computer science engineering once you've graduated, right? You could do it a couple of years out. Maybe you could switch if you saw what's happening. But that's the problem with a specialized degree. It's only good for your first job. If you're looking for a job in hospital administration or casino management, and if the casinos aren't hiring the year you graduate, what are you going to do? Mm. You'd probably be better off in lots of ways, even in the job market, with a liberal arts degree.
Well, that was my next question, whether this is really an argument for that liberal arts degree that is about philosophy and English and history and all those.
Well, I think there's a strong argument for it even in economic terms, and here's why. One thing is you ought to be thinking past the first job, which doesn't place you in a lifetime career anymore, right? The companies aren't going to manage your career for a life anymore. So how is this education going to help you after you get your first job, and particularly if you have to switch fields? There's a really interesting study that was done in England that compared students in Scotland – who have a U.S. kind of education. They have basically kind of a liberal arts broad education, 4 years, and then they focus in their last year on a major. So it's sort of like the U.S. Mm-hmm. Compared to England, where they go for 3 years, and it's all on one topic. If you do chemistry, that's all you take is chemistry for 3 years. And what they found looking out was that, first of all, the English students with the one set of courses were much more likely to change fields. I think partly because they got out and realized, well, you know, I've never seen anything else. I really like this other stuff. And the second, when they changed fields, they did significantly worse in the labor market than the Scottish kids did. And, you know, it certainly seems it has something to do with the breadth of training that you got in Scotland or breadth of education that you didn't get in England.
And that's Peter Capelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book, Will College Pay Off? A Guide to the Most Important Financial Decision You'll Ever Make. And we have calls coming in fast and furious, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Colleen from Mullica Hill. Colleen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, Colleen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, I'm listening to this, and I actually am a college professor as well as a clinician, as a nurse practitioner, so I have tons and tons of college, and I think it's good if you need it. But in the years that I've been working, I find people that are in college because their families wanted them to go. They don't really want to be there. They don't want to be in the major they're in, and I ask them, you know, what did you do or how did you prepare? And almost to exclusion, none of these kids were ever told about anything different in high school than college. They discounted, you know, trade schools, technical colleges, places like that. And a lot of them sound like they would have been interested in that. But, you know, in high school, I think they don't realize that. It's other people's jobs to tell them. And we are facing a big shortage of people that are skilled. I think most people to get a good-paying job you need to have some kind of education after high school, but I don't necessarily think it needs to be college, and I think that's something that really needs to be kind of addressed and way before people are graduating from high school.
Colleen, you raise I appreciate the call. You raise a number of really good points, which is that kids are going to college unprepared and really uninterested in going to college, Peter.
Yeah, I think that's right, and it's a great point because one of the reasons this is such a dilemma about going to college is the alternatives for not going to college have kind of collapsed, right? In a couple of ways. One is apprenticeship programs where you could have gone and learned a trade and you didn't need money to do it because you were paid, not a lot, but something while you were working. Those have just about collapsed in the U.S. So they fell by 50% just in the year 2000s. It's in the aughts. And
is that because of the decline of unions?
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with the decline of unions, and companies can't quite figure out how to run these things themselves, so nothing has replaced them. And then vocational education has sort of disappeared, and I think some of that was a political decision, frankly, and the political decision was the concern that kids were being tracked into vocational education and they would never get the college experience that would allow them to have access to the bigger jobs. But now I think, you know, one of the things which has changed is you can always go back to college, right? And you can always finish college. So I think the idea that you're shut out, it really isn't true. And I think when vocational education collapsed, it meant that you've now got to go to community college to get the kind of vocational training that you used to be able to get for free in high school, and now you got to pay for it, which is another hurdle for kids.
Colleen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. This is Philip from Westchester says, regarding the cost of college, in 1981, I graduated from a private New York university at the cost of $8,000 a year. We were solidly middle class, and my father made about $35,000 a year as a white-collar professional. That same university is now over $50,000 per year, and that same parental job now pays about $100,000 a year, 50% of his income before taxes. The only financial aid is a $6,000 federal student loan. This is not sustainable. I mean, you're saying, yes, a lot of these private universities can help people out, but he's saying, or yes, he, Philip from Westchester, saying it's not enough.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and it's a great point. You know, college has gone up three times faster than inflation over the last 20, I think, or 30 years, and wages are roughly flat. So the ability to pay is way down, which is something that, you know, we really have to rethink, particularly those of us who went to college, and the assumption was everybody ought to go, but we've cut government funding for it. The costs have gone up. The ability to pay has dropped. And one of the things we need to think much more about are student loans, which we sort of thought as a benign thing, right? And now it's turning out that they're not benign at all. And we really have to think carefully about how they operate and whether you should take them out.
Are you saying that, the access, the ability to have student loans has actually increased the cost of college?
I don't know if that's true. It's an interesting point. It certainly for the for-profit schools, which have had incredibly high default rates, something like half of the or maybe more of the default rates, the story in the papers today about this, comes from the for-profit colleges, which only enroll 12% of the students, although 12% when we were in college was zero, right? So it jumped to 12% just in the last decade or so. They have incredible default rates, and for them, you can actually make money even if kids default, right? Because you get paid. And the loan goes to the student. The student and the government then end up, or local banks end up fighting over it. But you've got your money. The kid is gone, but, you know, maybe you just don't have to teach that class.
Well, let me read. This is an editorial, I guess, in the New York Times today. A federal district court judge in Washington on Tuesday upheld new Obama administration rules that will deny federal aid to career training programs that saddle students with crushing debt while giving them useless degrees in return. Now, this, I think, it will be fought out in Congress, but nonetheless, that's sort of a piece of a very serious problem we've been talking about.
Right, and I think that's the problem of marketing trumping you know, customer knowledge. Lots of good stories about what you can do with your degree afterward. No evidence of it, but the marketing sells the kids and the government gives them the loans and off they go.
We have Bill from, looks like, West Hampton to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm a former vocational school recruiter, and I have good news for your guests, is that the vocational schools in New Jersey, the public ones that are county-based, still exist and are still doing a great job. They give high school students the opportunity to learn a marketable skill while they're still in high school for free, while providing them with the academic courses they need to go on to college if they choose. But what I thought for 25 years was the formula. And the formula is the opinion in the parents' mind that if their child takes college prep courses and then goes to college, they will get a big bucks job. And it's probably the biggest lie in education. Hmm. The second biggest lie is that the type of school, you know, what tier you go to also matters. The reality in real life is the only thing an employer cares about is what skill and experience do you have that will make me money or solve my problem. Where you got it, they don't care. An example is my brother-in-law manages a packaging manufacturing plant, makes $200,000 a year, doesn't have a college credit to his name, but did go to Gloucester County Tech and took sheet metal and welding. My brother went to Tulane University, majored in electrical engineering, and is making $94,000 a year.
Interesting. Well, Bill, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and that's really something that you say in your book as well, Peter, which is that when employers are looking, I mean, they care to some degree, but they want to know about your experiences.
Yeah, when you ask in a survey done recently asking employers what do they look at in college graduates, new college graduates, and Number one thing thereafter is internships in your field. Number two is other employment you've had. Number three is your college major. But number four is extracurricular activities, I think. And number five is other work experience. So out of the top five things, only one of them has anything to do with your classroom experience in college. So I think that's right that, you know, the caller's right. They are really interested in your skills. The problem is, how can you demonstrate that you've got the skills? Well, if you've worked someplace else, that's great, right? That's what they want to see. But if you're – how do you begin, right? Since everybody wants to hire somebody who's already worked for somebody else, how do you begin? And that's what the colleges have been tapping into, is they're sort of promising we can short-circuit this process for you. But it's not clear that they can. It's not clear the employers actually care that much about these very vocational degrees.
You also seem to push back against employers who don't want to train there. I guess they want employees that are perfect and ready to go, and they don't need any training or retraining and just hit the ground running.
Well, you know, there's kind of a big myth about all these arguments about skills gap, right? And all these arguments and all the evidence, and I say that in quotes, comes from employer complaints. But the employer complaints are in the survey data where these studies have been done, reports have been done, they ask an open-ended question, which says, are you having trouble finding the people you want? And then the assumption is that they're talking about trying to fill these jobs with school leavers, but they're not. Huh. They only fill about 5% of jobs from people out of school. So 95% of vacancies are filled from people who have experience already. And the jobs are written, job descriptions, are looking for very specific experience. So these complaints about skill problems are problems, 95% of them, with existing work, can't find existing workers on the outside who are already employed someplace else who I'd like to hire. That's the problem.
And that's Peter Capelli, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, a professor of management at the Wharton School, director of Wharton Center for Human Resources, and author of Will College Pay Off? Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Peter Capelli about college and jobs and if there's a connection between the two and student debt as well. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. In fact, during the break, we were talking about making sure we do spend a little time, more time, talking about student debt and I guess loans in particular.
Right. I think, you know, most parents would flip out if your kid took out a car loan at $40,000. But student loans are way more onerous than college loans. First of all, the cheapest student loans, which are called federal direct subsidy, are 4.8%. Car loans, I think, now are about 3 or 2%, right? So it's still pretty expensive. And you can't get that much in federal loans at that rate. So all the other loans are 7%, which is huge, right?
It is huge.
Right now. And here's another thing about them. Most of the student loans, with the exception of some of these the federal direct subsidized loans, interest accumulates from the day you take the loan out. So if you're thinking, well, I will – this is great. I got a loan. I'll start paying it off when I graduate. The loan's accumulating principal and interest is compounding during the course of your college year. So if you take like a typical student 5 years to graduate – by the time you've graduated, the effective rate, because the principal has gone up, is about 11% per year, right? Because you've got 5%, you know, 7% over 5 years starts to compound. It adds about a third more to your principal by the time you graduate. And then you can't get out from under them. Declaring bankruptcy doesn't do you any good, right?
Because you can't do that,
right? You can't do it, right? Can't get out from under those. So, you know, it's a pretty serious issue once you start taking out these loans, and you better, if you don't know much about them, I would really get some advice from somebody who understands finance, and that's not going to be your loan officer. Right? That's going to be somebody who, a lawyer, an accountant, or some friend who's close to this stuff, to give you a sense of just how onerous this is. By the way, there's a ton of information that the federal government provides on this. They got calculators that will tell you how much you have to earn in order to pay off different kinds of loans. You know, if you go to the Department of Education's website, which is www.DE. No, I don't know.
DED, Department of Education,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, DED.gov. And you can usually trace them down from there. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty serious stuff to take out these student loans. And then when you graduate, it changes the career you want to take because some of the jobs don't pay enough for you to get a good start on life. Credit card debt has now been passed by student loans. So student loans are the second biggest source of debt in the United States now, second only to mortgages.
So why do we make things so complicated in this country? As you were talking, I was thinking about our health care system. I mean, yes, more people are covered, but it's still so complicated.
Yeah. There's a lot of similarities between healthcare and higher education, a lot of government rules and, you know, a lot of cross-subsidying going on.
Right.
I think it's, you know, our penchant for, first of all, decentralized government. So you got state programs and local programs. The federal government doesn't fund much of higher education at all. It only funds these student loans, maybe 2% total support for higher ed. It's the states that are paying for the state universities. The local government's paying for the colleges. So they've each got their own regulations. And then when you come to loans, you got the banks in there as well because we've tried to privatize a lot of this, you know. So every one of those transactions adds a layer of bureaucracy to it. But you're right. You got to be pretty sophisticated to not get tripped up by this.
We have a tweet from H. Quinn saying, I just want to point out that it's possible to crawl out from under the debt mountain. I paid off $80,000 in 10 years on a low salary. And, you know, congratulations for doing that.
Yeah.
But here's, you know, here's our young people just starting their career. And, we're making it so hard on them. And yet we need them to start their career so that they can have a career.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think one of the reasons we make it hard, maybe the reason, is because the policy was driven by the notion that you're going to make out from a college degree, so you should be able to pay for it, right? And that was the underlying assumption that allowed states to feel, you know, reasonable about increasing costs and allowing us to push aid onto student loans because the idea was you're going to make all this extra money and it's worth it to you, so you should be able to pay for it. Now, the problem is, you know, making more money than a high school graduate doesn't necessarily help you do this. Because the high school the reason that gap has grown, by the way, is because high school wages have collapsed. It's not because college wages have moved at all. They're not up at all. It's just that the opportunities for high school kids have collapsed. And part of the reason they collapse, frankly, is because college grads can take the jobs that high school grads used to take. You hear this a lot. You know, the unemployment rate is half for high school grads what it is for college grads. And the assumption is often made that means there's more jobs for college grads. It's not. That's not true. It's just that their ability to take the jobs that high school grads take now is much greater.
So we've got overeducated people.
You can see this with secretaries now, where secretary jobs require college degrees, right? Didn't used to.
Let me see what Allie from Philadelphia has to say. Allie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I have a sort of unconventional college experience. I, right out of high school, went into college not knowing really what I wanted to do and not realizing that what I wanted to do, there was no major for what I wanted to do. And went to school for 2 years and then moved to New York and worked professionally for 7 years and then came back to school about 3 years ago and finished and did some night school and some other things during my time in New York. But you know, I realize that this is geared towards money making and the upsides and downsides of that. But I just want to highlight the importance of college having nothing to do with a job, but having to do with discipline and social benefits that really can be learned elsewhere, because I've been on both sides of it. And I think that there's something missing if your goal is just income based.
It's a very good point, Allie. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Peter Capelli, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point, and it's a reminder about, you know, all the talk about the promise of online education, the MOOCs, you know, the online courses, and so far there's not very many people who are actually offering degrees that way, but no doubt the state legislatures will start thinking this is a great idea. The problem is with these online courses, first of all, very few people ever finish any of those courses, right? Hundreds of thousands of people sign up, three or four actually complete them. And if you think about it, we had all this technology before, you know, all the great ideas in a course, all outlined in a way you could go back and forth and stop and take it anywhere. It was called a textbook, right? Huh. You could have bought a textbook and sat in your room and learned organic chemistry, but nobody ever did. And the reason is because the social context of a university and a college campus creates the motivation and the structure that allows you to do it. So I think if we move to these online courses, you know, maybe there's pressure to make it a lot of graduates. You can just cut the standards and get people to graduate. It's not that hard to do that. But will people actually develop the skills, the life skills that you would learn on campus? It's pretty hard to see how that's going to happen.
Ali, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. A tweet from Caroline who says, what about schools like Drexel, which offer internships during the school year? I think this is a good idea for students who want jobs.
I think that's right. Now, let's talk about internships, which is something different than what Drexel does. Internships, as you probably know, for private companies, employers are supposed to pay you for an internship unless you are doing it simply for learning and not contributing in any way to the mission of the business. If you're getting college credit for it, then you can do it, right? And for these internships, if you go to a college that offers, you know, as part of the curriculum, internship for college credit, you got to stop for a second and think about how much you're paying in terms of tuition for that work experience. Hmm. You know, so it's not it's worse than free, right? Because you're actually paying, you know, a course equivalent credit, which can be thousands of dollars, for the ability to volunteer to do some experience, which you probably could have done anyway if you just volunteered. Hmm. Now, what Drexel does is different, and I think everybody agrees it's a great idea. And those are co-op programs where the experience in the class and the experience in the workplace are linked up in some way, right? So that the coursework mirrors what the kind of work that you might be doing in the co-op experience, and the co-op folks know what you're doing in class, and they've worked together to pull them together. That's pretty hard stuff to pull out. And I think it requires employers who have commitment, so they're not going to just pop in this year and be involved and then drop out next year when they decide they're not hiring. And that seems to be the big roadblock. So everybody thinks it's a great idea, but there's still Drexel and Northeastern, and that's about it in terms of places that really do serious co-op programs because they're hard to get employers to do.
But I always think with internships or volunteering or any sort of experience that you have, if you can get your foot in the door and prove yourself and there's an opening, that is often an entree into a job.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the answer to this in terms of making the transition from college easier is pretty obvious. We've known it for a long time, and it's as you're describing, to try to get employers and schools closer together, right? So that you don't have the, you know, the employers standing over on one side of the U.S. and their associations are yelling at a group of colleges about we want more STEM people. That doesn't do any good. You know, it's the local employers talking to the local colleges and the hiring managers and the professors talking to each other about what they need. You know, that's what works. The broad discussions do nothing, really.
Let me get to it. Looks like Steve from Medford to join us on Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. So I just wanted to bring up a point that the speaker mentioned before the first break. Actually, two points, both of which have happened to me. I'm a college student now, and I feel that in my high school education, I was set up in a way to be put in remedial classes because we relied so heavily on calculators. And I took a placement test, which required no calculator. I was actually barred from using a calculator in that placement test and got put back into algebra. Huh. So I took two steps back when I was already going into my sophomore year of college. And I also have worked through my – I'm actually going to be a senior in college now. So I've worked through all 3 years consecutively. And the course scheduling is another problem that I've run into. Just overall, it's really hard to schedule courses in a manner that allows me to work part-time outside of school and commute to school. And I was just –
Sure.
That's something that really struck me
Well, Stephen, I know I'm really glad you raised that. And here's someone, you know, trying to make this work by working and also going to school at the same time. Do we make it too hard for the Steves of the world?
Well, we sure do. I think, you know, it's not possible really to work your way through college anymore. It used to be possible you could do it, even at a minimum wage job. And that's when tuition was much lower and minimum wage in real terms was much higher. But you really can't do it now, even at a state college, unless you go part-time, and there are people who do that. I think this issue of getting the courses is something that before you pick a college, you ought to think carefully about, and here's just a couple things to think about. If you're going to a small college and you see that they've offered 80 or 90 different majors, this is kind of like walking into a neighborhood diner, and they give you the menu for Italian food and Chinese food and Lebanese food, and you're saying, you know, if you're smart, you're saying, is there any chance they can pull all these off? And the answer is probably not. And a college, it's very unlikely they're going to be able to deliver 90 majors in a small place in any kind of consistent way or reliable way. And the second thing you want to do is to look at the majors themselves you're interested in and see how many requirements they have. And the thing that is a killer are requirements that say you must have this course as a prerequisite to that course. Because if you got three of those stacked up, something happens with any of them and you're messed up, right? So you can kind of predict a little bit how easy it's going to be to actually finish your courses and finish your majors. And maybe the last point is I would go to some place that allows you to switch majors easily. Most kids do change majors, and if you're at a place that's got all these prerequisites and makes it difficult for you to hop from one to the other, you really put a step behind and likely not to finish on time. And all that stuff you can probably see before you walk in.
Steve, good luck to you. Let me get Doug from Malvern. Doug, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on something was said before about having skills versus picking the college, the education, and then also I want to talk about social skills.
Well, you know what, Doug, only because we only have a minute or so for your comments, so go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think the when I'm interviewing someone, I want to see if that person can fit in the organization. Can he handle stress? Does he deal with difficult people? And that is almost the most important thing when I'm trying to hire someone, because people dynamics is crucial. And someone said to me once, if it wasn't for people, business would be easy. So I wanted to throw that out to your guest.
No, I'm glad you did, Doug. I appreciate the call. Sorry to cut you off there. Yep. I'm watching the clock here, but I'd like to get Peter a chance
to
respond.
Yeah, he makes a great point, and I think it raises another opportunity. What employers, I think, look for as evidence of that is whether you've done this before. And it's quite possible now, I think, for a kid to get a college degree in liberal arts or something that you think is not marketable and get internship experience in the summers, maybe, and maybe it's unpaid, and take a few practical courses maybe in some programming or something like that, and have enough to be able to persuade an employer that, yes, I could step in and do this job because I've done this. I've done other jobs before. Employers, they say they much prefer that than the fancy major that looks like it's smack dab on your field.
What I hear from Doug's comment is also the importance of people skills. I mean, you can't go to People University to learn those skills.
Online, anyway.
Well, certainly, I guess.
But extracurricular activities is what they're after. Then.
Right.
They want to see.
But you're also saying that college is a social experience as well.
Right.
And that's
right.
Where you can learn some of those people skills,
right.
I guess.
Right.
Well, on that note, Peter Capelli, thank you so much for joining us today
on
Radio Times. And again, we've been talking about his new book, Will College Pay Off? A Guide to the Most Important Financial Decision You'll Ever Make. Appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, and how to follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, with Sophie Reed this week. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.